Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Southern Peanut Growers, committed to making sustainable more attainable for chefs and cooking enthusiasts worldwide.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila, delicious and smooth tequila, meaning harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I have an amazing, amazing show today. We are welcoming Helena Bottomiller-Evich, a senior food and agricultural reporter at Politico, where she writes about the policy and politics that shape our food system from the farm bill to school lunch. Helena has received numerous well-deserved awards for her work, including a George Polk Award for a series on climate change and two James Beard Awards for features on nutrition and science. Before joining Politico in 2013, she was a reporter at Food Safety News, which is actually where you came to my attention, Helena, where she covered deadly foodborne illness outbreaks and the run-up to Congress passing the most significant update to food safety law in a century. That would be the Food Safety Modernization Act passed under the Obama administration, for those of you who don't remember that. And her work is widely cited in the media. And she has also appeared in the Columbia Journalism Review and on NBC News. And soon, I have no doubt you will be appearing on many other outlets, my dear. So what is an amazing story is that Helena launched an investigation into the Food and Drug Administration. I didn't actually write down the title of the piece or the date, which was remiss of me, but basically it's about how the FDA essentially has kicked food and food safety to the curb in the service. I mean, understandably in COVID, but before that, it wasn't really doing its job either. So first of all, what was the name of the story and what date was it published so people can go back and read this?
Yeah, so the short headline is FDA's food failure, and right. It's from about a month ago. I actually don't have the date off the top of my head. I should. It's been about a blur of a month between that investigation posting and then now this infant formula debacle.
Right, which so you have also about a month written ago. Extensively about, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot is happening all at once. So
I meant to look
piece,
it up. While we're talking,
Google,
I will look it up and, and I'll
Google
give people
Politico
the date.
Food.
I have it in my pocket.
It should be the first thing that comes
up. You know, that pocket thing. Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. But anyway, let's start by talking. I know I love pocket. It saves my life. First of all, what prompted you to launch this investigation and how did you get so many people to talk? Like, I was amazed at the sources you were able to quote.
It's a great question. Thank you. So what's so interesting about this story is like, it is, I think, really shocking and really like kind of mind blowing for people outside of food world, but inside of food world, if you work in the food industry or in food policy, this story was not surprising to you. It was not news to you. Mm. It is openly discussed that food is not a high priority at FDA, that food policies take a really long time, whether it's food safety or nutrition. These are just normal, these are normal things. This is what we have come to expect. And so I think in some ways, this entire sector has just become so used to this that they almost don't realize how dysfunctional it is. So
right.
The reason I did this deep dive was actually I was talking to an editor that I've done a lot of my big pieces with, Peter Canellis, and he's not steeped in food world. And we were working on a story last spring about FDA and sort of how it hasn't set standards for heavy metals and baby food. And some of these guidances hang around for years and years and years, you know, like 2013. It's been like 10 years since some of these things have been finalized. And I mentioned something like, you know, oh, this is just normal. These are just the time. This is just how long it takes FDA to do things. It takes forever. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, you should really kind of step back and just explain why that is. Mm. Like basically reminding me, like, this is kind of a shocking thing to hear. Right. And so that's sort of the genesis. We started talking about it from there. And we actually talked about, you know, at one point, I remember Peter said to me, you know, why don't you do like the McKinsey analysis of what's wrong with FDA?
Right.
And lo and behold, like months later, I realized that like McKinsey was actually involved in the reorg that sort of, you know, made the decision making at FDA.
That surprised me enormously.
Yeah.
I was very so, because I think of McKinsey as being an entity that does, you know, economic analysis, analysis of banks and trading. And, you know, it never occurred to me that they would have been brought in to talk with FDA officials on how to reorganize and make their process more streamlined and more efficient, which in fact they did not succeed in doing, obviously.
Well, what's interesting is McKinsey actually had a really large contract with FDA, and it was like a $50 million contract, and it was to work on a lot of things, not just this. So there has been some really interesting and concerning reporting around McKinsey's involvement in FDA's like opioid policies and strategies, because McKinsey's consultants were also advising Purdue Pharma. So same time. So there is, if your listeners are interested in sort of a tangential or different topic, but it is sort of related in that it involves McKinsey, highly recommend the New York Times and ProPublica both done some really good reporting on that. Side note, but yes, so McKinsey apparently has been, you know, a really, really involved at FDA for several years.
Absolutely shocking. So you got people who were former FDA, you know, officials, cogs in the wheel, as it were, as well as quite a few people who are working there currently to talk about some of the problems. And it seemed as if they were all, as you say, sort of resigned. Like, it was just sort of shocking at how complacent they were with the status quo. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what they said, but also some of the structural flaws that have contributed to, you know, the various issues that you uncovered in the investigation.
Yeah. Well, just to give you one example, I think one of the top quotes in the story is from Stephen Ostroff, who was acting commissioner of FDA twice and was also one of the highest or the highest food official before he retired. And when I called him to ask about this story, and I note this in the piece, he was so ready to discuss like the concerns about structure and everything that he came up with like a list of, of his concerns. And he was very open that food has long been a back burner issue, that there's a lack of urgency. And this is a theme that is repeated across like current and former officials. And then also, you know, the food industry sitting on the outside and consumer advocates both get frustrated with FDA slowness, sometimes for different reasons, right? Like the consumer groups want them to take a harder line. Industry groups often just want clarity on like where things are headed. Even if they don't love what FDA is doing, they want to know what their rules of the road are, right?
So
everyone kind of comes at this from a different angle. But where there is broad consensus is just that it takes too long to get any of these things done. So like there's so many examples. You mentioned FSMA. We're 11 years into FSMA.
Right.
And we don't have an ag water standard, you know, a standard to regulate the water used in fresh produce.
Right.
I mean, sodium has hung around forever. We still don't have voluntary sodium goals. Those are going to kick in the next 2 years here. So, you know, you just go through these examples and I started joking that I needed like a spreadsheet or something to keep a list of, like, you know, I would talk to people and be like, hey, I'm doing this story on, you know, what basically why it takes FDA to do to it takes FDA forever to do anything. And people would go, oh my gosh, are you going to include, you know, grass and food chemicals? Are you going to include, you know, antibiotics and agriculture? I mean, the number of issues I wasn't able to include that also have really long timelines is kind of astonishing. And again, sort of proves out this theme even further. Like, the story could have been three times as long. It could have been a book.
Yeah.
I don't have time for this, but
I mean, literally you could write a book. You could write a book about this.
Yeah, I could.
But Helen, so what are the structural flaws? Like, why does it take so long for, say, you know, for to give that example that you just did about establishing water quality standards for cleaning produce. Now, this, for people who aren't aware of this, like, every time there is a spinach recall, a romaine recall, we all have seen those. They've come up in the news. You know, you do get, and they cause hundreds, sometimes thousands of cases of foodborne illness. And this has been ongoing for decades. And they've been working on this water quality standard for, I don't know, what, like 10 years? Mm-hmm. And they still don't have a water quality standard or even a method of enforcement. Can you explain to people why it is that it takes so long for these various, you know, investigations and policy decisions to be, you know, funneled through the whatever the bureaucracy is?
Yeah, you brought up structure, and I think that's a key thing to keep in mind here. So essentially, FDA is below the Department of Health and Human Services. So it regulates like a quarter of the economy or a fifth of the economy or something.
Wow.
Which is big, right? Consumer spending, think about it, includes like cosmetics, food, microwaves, drugs, biologics, medical devices, right? So it's a pretty sweeping agency. But because it's below HHS, the FDA commissioner, Senate confirmed, but they're not in the cabinet. So they're just kind of structurally a little bit lower down in the government when you think about it that way. Mm-hmm. Then there's the fact that the FDA commissioner almost always comes from more of the drug or medical product side. So, like, we have never, that I know of, seen a commissioner that was like really from the food side. I think we had one veterinarian that, you know, had maybe some more animal drug background, but, you know, it's almost always heavily on the, you know, the medical products and drug side. So then I think you get a natural sort of leadership tendency to focus more on these other issues. There have been some exceptions where commissioners will come in and they have a lot of interest in food, like David Kessler during the Clinton administration was really interested in nutrition, did the nutrition facts label for the first time. Recently, actually, the Trump administration, or Scott Gottlieb, who was commissioner during the Trump administration, he was tremendously interested in food issues. I mean, you would see him pushing the ball. He was trying to push the ball forward even on like sodium reduction, which was hard to get done even during the Obama years. And so there's a few exceptions, but for the most part, the commissioner is just not that interested in food issues. So that's the second one. And then thirdly, I think the structure at CFSAN itself, which is the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, which is FDA's like food division, they have structural and leadership problems there too. There's like an open power struggle between the top two officials right now. There's, I think, a deep-seated culture of being afraid to really do anything too controversial or anything that might kind of spark too much pushback or ire. And then there's the issue of the food industry being, you know, quite powerful on Capitol Hill. And one of the observations that Gottlieb makes in this story, which I think is so interesting, is saying that like the food industry goes to the Hill to push back on what FDA is doing pretty frequently. They do not, the drug industry doesn't do that for FDA. Like they kind of respect FDA's role and like authority. And so there's just a fundamentally different relationship with the industry, which is kind of an interesting wrinkle here.
I think that's fascinating. I mean, the idea that the food industry goes to Congress, congressional members, and says, oh, we don't like this proposed new standard for, mm-hmm. say, antibiotics in livestock, a subject which I return to again and again with increasing ire myself, because I can't believe that in the 12 years I've been doing this radio program, not one damn thing has changed. You know, there's been all this reporting about the implications mm-hmm. on worldwide health from overuse of antibiotics, and yet we still do not have mandatory regulations about what can be used in what circumstances and by whom. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying to me in a way is that the Center for Food and Center for Food Safety and Nutrition should really be spun off into a separate agency from the Food and Drug Administration, don't you think?
There are definitely experts who have made that case, right?
Yeah.
That we should have a single food safety agency, and you should wrap, like, you know, because we have this weird divide between FDA and USDA, right? USDA,
yes.
You have to have an inspector in the plant to operate, and FDA has a much different model where they are more likely to inspect like once every few years. So, you know, shouldn't there be sort of a unified strategy on food safety? And I think maybe intellectually you can make that argument. I think politically it's darn near impossible to actually make that happen. But certainly there are people on Capitol Hill, including House Appropriations Chair Rosa DeLauro, who have made that case of like, why don't mm-hmm. we kind of centralize these functions? But I am not holding my breath about that happening.
Yeah.
I think most people agree, though, if you were to start over from scratch, you would not set up the system we have. I mean, food safety, I think, covers like, I think there's 12 federal agencies that are involved in some way in food safety. Like,
wow.
Think about EPA, they regulate pesticides. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, there's all sorts of different pieces of this
right.
that are spread out. And GAO, the Government Accountability Office, has like raised fragmentation in the food safety system as a concern for like a very, very long time, definitely more than a decade. So
right.
this has been a known challenge for a long, long time.
And what's interesting is that the numbers of foodborne illness outbreaks, which you know far better than I do from all your work with Food Safety Journal and whatever, Bill Marler and all that stuff, you know, they're in the tens of thousands a year, with thousands of people dying every year from foodborne illness. So you'd think that with those statistics being what they are, that there would be, you know, a little bit more of a fire in the belly to kind of get this right. I mean, it's hard for me to compare this to Europe or other nations. I mean, you know, everybody's got their own reasons and problems for not being able to make the food supply as safe as it could be. But I think it's really astonishing how lax we are in this country. So I want to talk for a minute about another aspect. You mentioned the Office of Regulatory Affairs in your investigation. So we've already identified that there's a power struggle between FDA and the Center for Food Safety and Nutrition. Then there's the Office of Regulatory Affairs, which get, according to your piece, they get a lot of money to play with. But not much is being regulated, and there is very little to no transparency in that office. What exactly is going on there, and how do they fit into this equation?
Yeah, so in addition to the power struggle within CIFSAN, there's also this other division of FDA, ORA, the Office of Regulatory Affairs, mm-hmm. and that division oversees the inspectional force, so the inspectors that are not just inspecting food, but also drugs and biologic facilities, so and others. But that division gets something like 2/3 of the food safety budget for the agency. So like the foods, the money that Congress gives FDA for the foods program, the vast mm-hmm. majority of it goes to ORA. Mm. But there's a lot of questions about like, how much CIFSAN, the food division, really has a say over how ORA spends that money. And they are doing fewer and fewer food safety inspections, even though they are getting more and more money. And so some members of Congress and definitely some food safety advocates have raised questions like, can you better explain how you're spending this money? Can you have more transparency over how decisions are made. So there is some pressure on that piece of it, which I think FDA Commissioner Robert Califf, who's going to be before the House Appropriations Committee this week, I can imagine he will get some questions on that this week.
Yeah, I certainly hope so.
In addition to getting grilled by Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, I think she's going to bring the fire. I mean, she is so outraged about this infant formula situation in particular.
Yeah,
so.
I want to have time to talk about that. But before we go there, I want to, you know, we talked a minute ago about the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is supposed to fix a lot of the issues that we have touched on here, most notably the water quality standards, food safety modernization, also included regulating antibiotics in livestock, as I recall, and some other stuff. What are some of the other places where, say, the Office of Regulatory Affairs, they're supposed to be pushing inspectors into the field? They are different from the inspectors that the USDA sends out to meat plants. So this is, let's make it clear that this is not the same as USDA. This is part of the food safety, you know, apparatus of FDA. Are they the ones who are supposed to be regulating what's happening, say, in, you know, spinach farms and lettuce place, you know, things like that? Mm-hmm. Is that what their role is to be identifying the problems from field to fork, as it were, when it comes to food safety that is not meat?
Yes, they definitely have a role in that. Although the vast majority of inspections are actually being contracted and done through the states. So the state, Department of Ag. Yeah, so there's a lot of different moving parts here.
Wow. That's
so
really
the states are doing more of the inspections. And also, you know, the states are able to do these inspections for a lot less money per inspection than FDA can. So there's a little bit of tension between the states and FDA about, like, who's doing what. And the other thing I can tell you is that I've talked to some state inspectors, and they were not impressed that FDA, during the pandemic, basically kept all their inspectors at home. They didn't do really any routine food safety inspections, other than, quote, mission critical, although somehow mission critical didn't include all of the infant formula plants, which we've now learned.
Right.
So the states were like, wait a minute, we were back on the job, you know, I don't remember how many months. I think every state was a little bit different. So there's some tension there. But yes, the states, the food safety money that FDA has is supposed to help do oversight across all foods, and that would include produce.
Right.
But, you know, FSMA, part of the reason why FSMA was so hard is that it really put FDA in a role of even having any jurisdiction over farms for the first time. And even that, I think, is still a little touchy.
Huh.
Right. So, yeah. We never had like federal food safety anything for
produce, for farms and produce, right? Which would explain why the water quality standard of what you wash those vegetables in, you know, cannot be coming from a source where they're spraying a manure for fertilizer next door, which is why so often you find spinach or lettuces or whatever contaminated with E. coli. I mean, just to kind of identify for people how that happens. Mm-hmm.
Right. Sorry, and it's also the water. It's also the water used to irrigate. So like in Yuma, Arizona, they have like open irrigation canals, right? So
I see.
But they're, you know, in vicinity of a large CAFO with like tens of thousands of head of cattle. So, you know, it's not rocket science how some pathogens in the environment can then, you know, get in the water and then potentially get in the lettuce or the different greens. So, you know, there are some real challenges with that FDA is aware of, that, you know, producers are aware of, that the states are aware of, and yet we just haven't quite gotten to the heart of that issue. We haven't quite tackled it because it just keeps, it keeps happening.
Well, it keeps happening. And they're, you know, as you said, it's to get people to inspect and then to further, you know, insist on regulations and make sure that those regulations are being implemented and so on and so forth. I mean, it's costs money. It takes manpower. And obviously that's not happening. We need to take a short break now for a sponsor drop. And then when we come back, I really want to talk really for the rest of the show about this infant formula thing, because it's become such a political football. And, you know, it is essentially so, well, anyway, predictable in some ways. But we'll be right back.
This episode is proudly supported by Southern Peanut Growers, who are spreading the word about peanut sustainability. As the planet's resources are strained to meet the nutritional needs of its populations, many responsible chefs are doing their part by sourcing local and sustainably raised food. Many are surprised to learn that peanuts are one of the most sustainable plant-based proteins available. Southern Peanut Growers created the campaign Making Sustainable More Attainable in partnership with award-winning chef Steven Satterfield. Together, they're bringing the sustainability message to chefs nationwide. Whether it's conserving water, minimizing fertilizers, or achieving zero waste, peanuts are a logical choice for your next menu. Southern Peanut Growers represent farmers across Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, and Alabama. For more information, visit www.peanutbutterlovers.com.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainably managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Okay, so even today in Morning Ag, Politico's Morning Agricultural Report, which I hope people are subscribing to, you had a little piece about the infant formula recall. Now, one of the things, somebody sent me a piece about this. I haven't read it as thoroughly as I should have. But to start off with discussing this, let us explain to people that the number of companies that are allowed to make formula in this country are very small. Like so many other aspects of our food system, they are highly concentrated monopolies. So let's start with that, and then I want you to give a quick sort of timeline of how this played out and what the role of the FDA should have been and hasn't been.
Yeah, the consolidation piece is so interesting, and that's really getting a lot more attention now. You know, you're well aware, your reader, your listeners, you know, you hear about consolidation in meat packing or the, you know, ag chemicals or fertilizer or even, you know, seeds, I think get more attention. But infant formula, you never hear anything about this. But there are about four companies that control nearly 90% of the U.S. market. The two big ones are Abbott and Mead Johnson. They control, I don't know, something probably like two-thirds of the market. So we're talking really consolidated, even more consolidated than some of these other industries
that we pay attention companies. To. Right.
Mm-hmm. So this is starting to get a lot more attention, particularly from Democrats on Capitol Hill. They have asked USDA and the FTC to take a look at this. I think we're going to hear more on this front because the shortage is getting a ton of attention. It's causing a lot of people to sort of look under the hood, right? Mm-hmm. And say, what, you know, why is this happening? And I think there's a lot of contributing factors, but consolidation is clearly going to be a hot topic. We don't have that many companies that are really major players here. And there's also been some questions about what role the WIC program might have played in fueling consolidation or encouraging it, because WIC, which helps low-income families that are either pregnant or have young children get like healthy staples. They also provide free formula and breast pumps and things like that. WIC probably buys about half the formula-ish. We don't really have great up-to-date numbers on that, but a huge chunk of the U.S. formula market is WIC. So
right.
WIC does exclusive contracting state by state. So companies bid for contracts and then they get the exclusive rights to the whole state. And this really, really affects not only, you know, obviously what WIC options there are, but then also the retail options and sort of the demand in that state is affected by that. So Democrats are now saying, look, you know, we don't blame WIC. We love the WIC program, but are there, you know, maybe some things that can be done to encourage competition and maybe make sure that one of these federal nutrition programs isn't exacerbating consolidation. So I think that's going to be something that's looked at as well in the coming months.
So how did this, so remind me of what happened here. So Abbott, a couple of babies, or actually, I don't know, what was it, about a dozen infants came down with a bacterial infection, right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so four, basically we all learned about this in February. So February right. 17th, FDA and Abbott announced this really massive recall, which included Similac. Abbott Nutrition makes Similac, which is the number one brand in the U.S., and it included mm-hmm. a couple of other brands as well. So this was probably the largest recall, the infant formula recall in history. We don't yep. exactly have the volume, but it was quite big. So then once this recall happened, I noticed that the first illness had been all the way back in September, right? So we're talking about February. The first report of an infant being hospitalized was in September.
Right.
In total, there were four infant hospitalizations and two deaths that were reported, and that is what sparked
the recall
this whole situation.
Right.
So basically what happened, after the recall happened, we then started to learn more about the run-up. Essentially what happened is February, there was a hospitalization that was reported from Minnesota. And the same week that the hospitalization was reported to FDA, FDA inspectors were in that plant, in the Abbott Nutrition plant in Sturgis, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And it appears they were not told about the hospitalization. So they weren't looking for Cronobacter. We don't even know if they swabbed the plant for that bug. They don't normally do that unless they have sort of reason to be looking for it. So it just is a coincidence they were in there, and they hadn't been in there in 2 years, even though normally they would be there every year. Like that's the typical sort of cadence for infant formula inspections. They happen much more often than regular food inspections because it's a very vulnerable population, obviously. So, So they were in there after 2 years. They found some issues, but nothing like super serious. There was no warning letter, no, regulatory action from there.
Okay.
Then we learned in October, top FDA officials got a whistleblower warning from a former plant employee.
Whoa.
Basically, yeah, alleging that like not only did this plant have food safety issues, but that they were falsifying documents, like records. They were like on purpose hiding things from FDA inspectors, really some serious, serious allegations. 34-page single-spaced document, like really serious, sent to seven officials at FDA. They did not interview that whistleblower until December.
Oh, my God.
I know. So in the meantime, you had three more reports of infant hospitalization. Yep. You had two deaths reported. And then FDA went back into that plant January 31st. So we're talking September, October, then January 31st. November, they go back into the plant. They found really serious issues when they went back in January, including, you know, repair issues, standing water, like lack of food safety controls. And they found five strains of Coronabacter. So that's the bacteria we're talking about here.
Right.
Then they recalled February 17th. So that's like the top line of the lead up timeline. So there are many, many questions about why this took so long, why decisions were made. Members of Congress have a lot of questions about this, as do I. I mean, I've had a really hard time getting answers from FDA.
What
to
a surprise.
Explain their decision making. Yeah, I know. Shocker. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, do you think that FDA, I mean, will heads roll because of this? I mean, what do you anticipate? There's going to be a congressional oversight hearing, right?
We're having Commissioner Califf is going before House Ag Approps Thursday, but then next week, next Wednesday, Congress has scheduled two infant formula hearings on the same day. House Energy and Commerce Committee is holding a hearing, and also the full Appropriations Committee is holding a hearing. So, Congress can't force anyone out of FDA that I know of. I think that would have to come from leadership at FDA, but I have not heard anything about any sort of direct personnel response or anything like that. But a lot of groups on the outside are really trying to pressure Califf to think about restructuring the food program so that A, someone's in charge of it and clearly in charge of it, and B, so that, you know, maybe they're more responsive to sort of outside concerns because, as I mentioned, like, it's not like one group is frustrated with FDA. Everyone is frustrated with FDA right now.
Including people within FDA as well as former people who have left the agency but who have plenty to say about how badly it's run. You know, the other thing, I mean, infant formula, you know, is grabbing all the headlines. But I haven't forgotten that there was an enormous amount of, but brief coverage of all of the neurotoxins, like arsenic in rice cereal, that pretty much every baby in this country is fed for a certain period of time. And then there were other issues with arsenic in formula in arsenic in baby food. In rice cereal, but there was also arsenic in something else, like in carrots. There was neurotoxins, mercury in carrots. I'm sorry, I'm being so incoherent here, but you know, I get too excited, and then I'm like,
right. Like the heavy metals issue
that hasn't gone away.
Blew up. No, that has not gone away. That blew up in Congress. Early 2021. So there was a big congressional report that had asked for documents from baby food companies about their testing practices and their internal test results. So FDA, as a result of that report and all the media coverage following it, FDA basically got publicly shamed into saying they will set standards for various heavy metals in baby foods, because we don't have standards, except for we do have a guidance action level for, you mentioned arsenic and rice cereal. That level that FDA set is 100 parts per billion, and health groups really don't feel that it is anywhere near strict enough to be protective of infant health, but it was essentially set to be like feasible for industry. And so they don't like that standard anyway, but it is the only standard we have for a specific baby food. The FDA did just finally some guidance on juice. I believe that was targeted at lead, but, you know, real narrow in where we actually have standards. So
right.
FDA is working on this. They're already behind schedule in what they committed to do last year. There's a standard, an initial standard sitting at OMB right now, but it basically took like a lot of public outrage, outrage from Capitol Hill and so on for them to agree to do this. And even though they've agreed to set standards, their timeline extends 3 years and beyond in terms of what they're going to do.
Exactly. I mean, we've just been discussing the fact that it's taken over 10 years to even come close to addressing water quality standards. And here we are feeding the infant population of our nation, you know, with heavy metals and neurotoxins. I mean, it's, you know, well, we'll let that ride for another few years and see what happens. I mean, it's really astonishing. We have only, I'd say, about 5 more minutes before people start tuning out our outrage here. and that's not because of you. It's all because of me. But the upshot of your piece, because let's go back to your investigative, you know, triumph here, is that the FDA is basically sloppy, incompetent, opaque, and riddled with corruption. They knuckle under the food industry via members of Congress who obviously tell them, oh, no, don't be investigating that right now because that I might not be getting my campaign contributions, and we don't want that. So what, from your discussions with, you know, the various members of, you know, Congress and former FDA officials and everything, did you get a sense of what can or should be done to, you know, do a better job of keeping our food supply safe for not just infants and children, but for all of us?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I don't think I would go as far as to say that FDA is corrupt. I think there is a lot of officials there who, well, I mean, yeah, just
you're
add a little nuance there.
You're
yeah,
a journalist, so you have to say that, but I'm not. So
you can definitely say what you want. This is a discussion.
It's my show.
Yes. But I think that a lot, you know, the vast majority of people who work at FDA are committed to public health, are trying to do the right thing. I think they work in a structure that is very difficult to navigate. And I think if you want to do something protective of public health, I think a lot of the structure and the politics and everything and the lack of staff and the lack of bandwidth, I think, create really major barriers to doing that. So, you know, I had FDA officials who still work, who are very much working at FDA, kind of quietly say, thank you for your story. I'm also frustrated, right? So I just want to make that point that it's not, I don't think it's that it's some sort of like malicious thing. I think it's sort of a structure that is sort of set up to fail in some ways. Uh-huh. But in terms of what to do, I think the question of leadership really, really comes up here. So our new commissioner for the FDA, Commissioner Califf, really has, I think, some decisions to make about whether or not to kind of listen to everyone on the outside and make some real changes within FDA's food program, or whether, I don't know whether he will heed those calls or whether he'll go more down the road of sort of status quo and sort of like, let's just move on from this. I don't know yet, but mm-hmm. everyone's sort of watching to see what kind of leadership he will show in response to all of this.
Where did he come from? What were his, you know, what's his CV? How did he get
to be? He's a cardiologist. Yeah, he's uh-huh. a cardiologist with a clinical research background. He was most recently, so he was actually FDA commissioner briefly during the Obama administration for about a year, mm-hmm. and now he's back. He most recently worked at Alphabet, which is the company that owns Google. So he was doing right. digital and sort of health strategy there. So he certainly falls into the category of like a really strong, mostly medical and like clinical research background. Does not have
right.
a background.
So again,
in food.
Doesn't not have a food safety or food, doesn't have a food background. So isn't, for instance, all plugged into the agriculture community or, you know, food manufacturing and so forth.
Yeah.
Doesn't
and
have
the,
that
the
background.
The other thing about food that's so interesting is that it is a much bigger and more complicated industry than like drugs or medical devices, which is just fewer companies, fewer players. And like, just think about like the number of commodities that we're talking about. Like even just within leafy greens, you've got like spinach that has different issues than romaine that has different issues than sprouts or whatever. And so I think it's kind of seen as like this very complicated morass compared to some of the other issues before FDA. So I think that's sort of the reputation that food has, is it's like this complicated and really messy area.
It is complicated.
Yeah, you and I know this. Yeah, I mean, it is.
But that doesn't mean
people have
that
knife fights over the small, seemingly small things.
Yeah. But it doesn't, I mean, to go back to the corruption issue, I don't mean to suggest to anybody that the people who work at FDA are, taking bribes on the side to look the other way when something bad goes down.
That would be very illegal. Yes.
I don't think that's what's happening. But I do think that succumbing to pressure about what kinds of regulations should be imposed on various aspects of the food industry, that I do believe is subject to corruption. And I do believe that there are probably people who are, if not turning a blind eye, just sort of, letting business proceed as usual because it's potentially a bomb for them if they were to meddle in the business of, trying to impose some sort of regulation that people don't like imposing regulations on the use of antibiotics in livestock, for example, which has been dragging on to the detriment of public health around the world. I mean, there's no disputing that this is going to be a very dangerous and volatile situation. And having just come off of this pandemic, or not even, we're not done with it. When we stop being able to use penicillin products, it's just the implications of this are so huge. And yet we cannot seem to drive, the Food and Drug Administration cannot seem to drive any kind of regulations across the finish line regarding the use of antibiotics. I think that's corrupt. I just do. There's something fundamentally very wrong with that.
Yeah, there's no question that there is major industry influence at FDA. That is not in dispute. Yeah.
So, that's where the rubber meets the road, is stuff like that. I mean, we have something like 27, what is it? The statistics better than I do. What is it? It's like 125 or 130,000 people a year are reported to suffer a foodborne illness from whether it's meat or leafy greens or sprouts. Probably around 25 or 30,000 people a year are dying from those same illnesses.
I think CDC's numbers are 128,000 hospitalizations and 3,000 deaths. And they also estimate that like something like 48 million people actually get some version of foodborne illness every year. Although a lot of those cases are norovirus, which I don't know if you've had recently, but
no,
it's awful.
I have to say,
I've had it twice this year.
You're kidding, really?
I assume that that's what I had. I mean, it was just awful. Yeah.
I've had it once. I'm not even sure that's what it was, but probably. I mean, I ate a bad hamburger and I was sick for about 3 days. And boy, you're right. You're really freaking sick, man. You are really sick. But fortunately, I've been lucky. Maybe because I don't eat out very often anymore. It's just there has to be some answer to this. Just as there has to be an answer to the consolidation of the baby food or the infant formula, industry is another place where there is, somebody is making bank on this stuff. And it's coming at the expense of babies and poor people and, all the rest of it. And there was a very interesting piece that somebody sent me about one of the reasons we can't get infant formula in this country is because of the trade agreement that Trump negotiated, which basically was supposed to protect the dairy farmers here. And that's why we can't import formula from Canada. Can you speak to that for just a second before we go?
Yeah, our trade team's actually planning to dive into this more deeply, but mm-hmm. but essentially the USMCA, the US-Mexico trade agreement that former President Trump signed, had some pretty substantial tariffs on infant formula, and I think we're going to see more attention on that. And then also we have a lot of FDA labeling requirements and sort of restrictions that prevent European formulas from being able to be right. imported into the US. And so we're actually expecting something from FDA soon on something in regards to relaxing some of those barriers. I'm not sure how far they will go. Right. But Canada right now is not having an infant formula shortage. And right. there was something going around on social media that, oh, moms just needed to go on Amazon Canada and they could just ship it to their house. And that's certainly not true. I can assure you, I actually tried to do that yesterday because I was like, huh, that's interesting.
Right.
And I'm visiting family in Washington State. So I'm about 2 hours south of the Canadian border right now.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And I can't order a product from Amazon's Canada.
Right.
Even though they have plenty of stock. So there's something to look into there, right? Like,
absolutely.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm afraid we have to close here, but thank you so much, Helena, both for your exemplary work and also for spending 45 minutes on the phone with me.
Happy to do it. Happy
and
to do it.
Keep
Thank
me,
you.
You know, keep Thanks me in the loop interest. for your next move. I'm excited for people who didn't yeah. read Morning Ag today. Helena is leaving Politico, off to start something fabulous and new of her own. We'll be reporting on that on this show whenever she gives me the go ahead. So I really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for doing this and for all the great work you've been doing and will continue to do in the future. I really look forward to it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You betcha.
And thank you for continuing to stay on these issues. I think it's important. So
I try to do my little bit. Anyway, thanks everybody for tuning in. Thanks so much to my sponsors, as always, for supporting this program and all the shows on Heritage Radio Network. Remember, you can listen to things like, Taste of the Past or Eating Matters. I mean, there's so many great programs on this station. So if you haven't dipped in elsewhere, please do so whenever you can. And we'd all be grateful for it. Thanks for listening. So long for now. That's it for today.
This show is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.